This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk. Today I'm talking to Doug Trevor. He's the author of a new book, or relatively new book at this point, called Girls I Know. How are you, Doug?
I'm great, David. Thank you so much for having me on.
Oh, it's a pleasure. I read your book, and I liked it. I think it's a kind of unusual in a way, because there's a certain quietness to a lot of the... I guess it centers on your main character, whose name is Walt Stedman. I kind of feel like he's in a quiet interior, kind of nebbishy guy. It sort of sets the tone for the expectations of the reader are changed through the course of the story. And I don't want to give away the plot, but I think it is mentioned on the cover that this major event occurs that changes his life. Aside from the major act, there are two kind of major points of action in the book. Most of it is kind of interior narrative about stuff that's going on for him that is, I don't want to say mundane exactly, but it isn't, it's not an adventure novel.
No, you're absolutely right. I mean, it's a quiet book in overt ways and kind of introverted ways. I mean, one of the central characters is an 11-year-old girl named Mercedes who doesn't really speak until almost the end of the book. And I think one of the things I was thinking through and processing as I wrote the book, especially in the initial drafts, were things that I didn't want to do or kinds of books I didn't want to write. So, for instance, Walt has some connections to the academic world, or at least he tried to. He has been a graduate student who attempted to write a doctorate, a doctoral dissertation, and failed. But I didn't want to write a novel that was a sort of an academic send-up. I didn't want to do that. And Walt has a relationship with a young woman named Ginger Newton, but I didn't really want to write a romantic book either. I felt like there were these niches and spaces between those kinds of narratives that hadn't been explored, at least to my knowledge, very frequently in novels. So I was trying to kind of work into those spaces.
And I think, you know, that comes across. Now, of course, the title of the novel, Girls I Know, has multiple layers of meaning, because within the story, this girl that he meets, who's a undergraduate at Harvard, Ginger Newton, is writing her own book called Girls I Know, where she's kind of crazily thinking that she can interview women from all walks of life. She's a kind of obsessive personality who has this energy that counterpoints Walt. His name is Stedman. I thought, oh yeah, Steadyman. You know, he's kind of this quiet, steady guy, and then he meets this ball of energy who's completely crazy and self-involved. Any perfect portrait, I would say, by the way, of a privileged, uber smart, completely out of control, indulged.
Right. It sounds like you've met some of these, as have I.
Yeah, I think we know this character, but you did her. I mean, first of all, you didn't. As you said, she's not a send-up. She's not a kind of stick figure. I thought she was really well. You sympathetically portrayed her as a real person.
Well, I grew to really like and admire her, actually. I felt like she softened by the end of the book to a degree, and she has some life lessons in the course of the novel, and I think your description of her is absolutely spot on. I would add to it, though, that there's something indomitable about her, something stubborn but also committed. I think I realized maybe a year into the project that in many ways I could identify with her as a writer, really, because I think as a writer, she has this project that you described beautifully that isn't quite a writing project, but kind of is. She wants to interview these women and compile these interviews into a book called Girls I Know. And I felt like, for me as a writer, that kind of, not the privilege, certainly, but the commitment to a task that sounds on the surface to be kind of crazy is sort of what we do as writers. So she really evolved in the course of me working on the novel, and also I think in the course of me growing older a little bit as I worked on the novel. I found myself distanced from her. She's kind of a contemporary of Walt's in the novel, but not quite. He's 29, she's 20. Walt makes more of that age difference, I think, than
right, she doesn't care. No, I actually know a person who I think would be the a great real life version of her, who is in exactly that way, kind of unconscious of the age of people that she talks. She doesn't build barriers. Like, you know, some people, 20 year olds often only want to relate to 20 year olds. They
right.
think if you're 29, you're an old person.
Right.
And she's not that way at all. She's very open to experience. The intrepidness that she has is really admirable. I mean, she's, again, I thought you really portrayed her well, but she is a complex person. And I like the idea that, you know, her intrepidness reflects the way you feel about writing, or the way many writers feel about writing. And I think it's probably true that there are, if you think about writers in general, artists in general, inventors, they're self-involved in the same way she is, and creating their own version of reality is really important to them. It doesn't mean they don't pay attention to what's going on in the outside world. In fact, they vitally do, but they're not bounded by the same rules of behavior that the average person is. And
that's
part of what distinguishes them. So I think she is perfectly, you know, in that way, drawn as a, you know, she's an artist.
Yeah, she really is an artist.
And of course, Walt, if you contrast him, is the others. He's, you know, the academic. He's the one who's contemplative, reflective, not able to do things. I mean, that's another characteristic probably that may be a little, you know, maybe, you know, many of us probably have bad attitudes about academics, but, you know, that he's not able to function in the world. The only place at this stage in his life that he can function is in academia, but he can't even do that.
Right. And so in a sense, I think with Walt, he's such an observer, and he's really a reader. I think I cut out in the end, because they just weren't that dynamic, many of the scenes in which the reader would have seen Walt simply reading. He has a variety of sort of small jobs to support himself in Boston, and one of them is working behind a counter at a dry cleaner's. And in the early drafts, I had a number of chapters where he would just sit there and read, and I cut them out, but they were helpful to me because they made me realize that I think a sort of intermediary space between the academic type who professionalizes reading and the person who doesn't read at all is this, in my mind, often highly idealized kind of person from a writer's point of view, who is someone who just consumes text.
Yeah.
But the thing with Walt is he just consumes the same text over and over. He just reads the,
well,
reads
that's,
the same
right,
sort of poem.
Right. And, but see, those, I think that actually is important, that in our society, because we're so committed to the idea of being productive, the idea of just reading is kind of not valued. You know, people always tell children you must read, but there's the idea, well, if you read, you'll learn something, you'll be a better person, you'll, you know, there's some outcome. And what you're really, you know, you're kind of highlighting is, for Walt, he just wants to experience. He can't transform it. He doesn't actually have the capability, I think, to be an academic, you know, to take the idea, you know, to apply it to what he's reading. But that's not necessarily a bad thing. I mean, he, you know, he feels it as a, you know, as a failure, I suppose. But, you know, part of the transformation of the novel, of course, this other thing that happens is that through the tragedy that occurs in the central part of the book, he ultimately he's able to become a teacher.
Right. And I was really interested in that migration for me. And it was something that I was thinking about from the earliest stages of the novel, which was how this person could become a teacher or connect with the idea of what teaching is about. I mean, I set the novel in January of 2001 consciously at the time because I wanted it to be a kind of pre-9/11 novel that was really focused on a domestic scene and the questions of violence that comes up in contemporary America that wouldn't be complicated by issues of the post-9/11 world. But I realized as I worked more on the novel that one of the really crucial elements of the book that makes it almost feel historical to me now is that in 2001, of course, we didn't have smartphones, but you didn't absolutely have to have a cell phone. I mention that just because I think Walt's, the context in which Walt does read and think and the quiet space that he inhabits through much of the book, I think it would be a much harder space to believe in now in some way in 2013.
Oh, no, I think that's right. I read something recently, I can't remember, that was talking about how certain stories, or oh, it was in the Times maybe, that movies that were made 20 or 30 years ago couldn't be made today the same way because, if you set them in the present, because of all the technology that we have. Now, I think that's actually a really interesting point that certain stories, storylines wouldn't, many of the things that happened in this book wouldn't work at all if cell phones or smartphones were ubiquitous. And would he be, because he makes no money, he would actually be, in some ways, he would be this outlier, you know, the guy with no phone.
Right. Oh, yeah, you're absolutely right. If it was set in 2013, the central descriptive feature of him would be the fact that he didn't have a cell phone. Also, there's a payphone that he uses at the end, toward the end of the novel, a couple times, called Ginger. And it never occurred to me in sketching out the novel. Well, it started to, I guess, I worked on the book for about 4 years. But so in 2010, 2011, of course, I realized, well, there are not many payphones around. But for instance, All the President's Men, one of my favorite all-time movies, has gotten a lot of attention in recent days because I think the anniversary of it has just passed. But I mean, that's I think a great example of what you're attesting to. I mean, the Woodward and Bernstein would probably, they would Google this information, or they would they would be talking to Deep Throat on their cell phones, and that would be it. I mean, the movie could be filmed in a single room. You wouldn't need to go to a parking lot or anything.
So. Right, and your character Ginger, her work life would be different. The way she does her research would be different if she had a smartphone. And plus, some things that happened to her probably wouldn't happen in the. There are all kinds of things you can imagine. So that is interesting. I actually did not notice it, which probably just means I'm not a good enough reader. But another thing I thought was interesting and I wanted to ask you about is going back to the title, Girls I Know. I realized after I read it that almost every relationship that your main character, Walt Stedman, has, those relationships are all with women, with I think one exception, which is this other grad student that he communicates with and hangs out with for a period in the book.
Javier.
Right. Yeah. Everyone else is female. Relates to his mother, his grandmother, Ginger, the women, principally the woman in the coffee shop where he goes for breakfast every day, her daughter, they're all, everybody is, it's all women.
Yeah. It's interesting that, I'll say two things about that if I could. One is that the title of this novel is so essential to the novel. I'm glad you've mentioned it. Not only because it's referring to a book that's in the book, but because the relationships of Walt to women is what the book is largely about. And so when I was crafting it, at certain junctures, there were some flashback scenes, for instance, in an earlier draft where we got to see Walt with his grandfather, who basically, along with his grandmother, raised him. But I ended up taking it out in part because I did want to emphasize the relationships that Walt had to women. And if for whatever reason I imagined hypothetically at certain moments toward the end of writing Girls I Know, what if I lost the title? And I didn't, with other things I've written, stories and what have you, I often have another title in the back of my mind that I can imagine using if need be, or if, say, my editor doesn't like the title I've come up with. But this was the title for this book. And I think in part I was also thinking about, I did a graduate degree in English literature, and one of my professors, a brilliant woman named Barbara Johnson, commented to me at one point that she thought the idea of the man, the idea of masculinity, was much less interesting now, maybe less interesting than it had ever been in the history of humankind, that we kind of exhausted that unattentiveness toward forms of masculinity. And I that's not overtly in the book at all, but there is something I think that's interesting about that. I think that Walt is not overtly aware of the demise of masculine categories, but the world is changing in Girls I Know. And
well, in a way, though, he is aware of that because he refuses to accept the kind of traditional imperatives of what men should be and do.
That's true.
He doesn't. He has grown up with women and doesn't think the way a kind of classic male figure does.
And, you know, I think one of the reasons why his imagined dissertation, which he's entitled The Poetics of Yankee Peerage, which is supposed to be a study of the poetry of Robert Lowell, I mean, that can't work for him because, in some sense, Robert Lowell is this kind of figure that I'm referring to, who received so much attention and praise when he was coming up through the ranks as a poet in the 50s and 60s, and is much less read now. You know, his best friend, Lowell's closest friend through much of his life, was the poet Elizabeth Bishop. At the time, a poet who got much less attention than Lowell did. Now, the absolute reverse is true. And I wondered a little bit if Walt had noticed these issues enough to have switched his dissertation topic from Lowell to Bishop, if he actually would have been able to write it. I think he might have, although he still would have had issues with his writer's block and what have you. But you're right, he's in a matriarchal world largely. You know, as a writer, I feel like I've been in a matriarchal world too. Most of the editors, the mentors I've had, my longtime agent are all women. My closest reading friends are mostly female colleagues. So
well, I think that's more possible today too, that what you describe in the book and maybe reflects your experience indirectly, but I think many, you know, in former time, you have to only think back to, you know, Lowell, but also think about all the beats, you know, basically male-dominated, the right. Female poets of that time or the female writers of that time got very little, much less attention. True, probably, you know, up to a certain point. And then there's this shift that, first of all, in general, men and women have different relationships than they did. There are more women in positions to be mentors or friends and right. are, you know, equals. So it's, I think it, you know, what you're describing is the social change of the last 50 years.
Right. I think that's absolutely right. It's interesting to think about that in the context of Walt, because I think you're right that he senses that he doesn't quite, that he doesn't fit into what would have been perceived to have been standard male roles, at least that were imaginable to him as a child growing up in Burlington, Vermont. I mean, his grandfather, who's only mentioned in passing, but his grandfather was a World War II veteran, history teacher, a little bit more, a high school teacher, but a little bit more on the spectrum, on that masculine spectrum than Walt is.
Yeah, the other experience he has that you kind of, I sort of thought was interesting. I know you were at Harvard in grad school, so this must come from your personal experience in some way, and that is his relationship in this dormitory of graduate students who are all these kind of nerdy, they're in other, you know, they're in other fields than his. They're mostly in science or,
right.
you know, social computer science and whatever. But there is a male, that's the only truly male world that you
right.
run across in the book. And he doesn't fit in there either.
No, you're right. You know, I love that you mentioned that because I did live in that on the third floor of Perkins Hall in my first year in graduate school. And it was an all-male floor, partly for the reasons that are mentioned comically in the novel, which is that the heat was so it was just a hot space that there were a lot of instances of these male graduate students walking around in their underwear and stuff in their bikini briefs reading chemistry books and stuff. It just struck me as a much younger writer at the time as kind of hilarious. And I had, again, it was one of those things that some of which ended up on the cutting floor. I had more stuff about those types of guys, but I got distracted from the central thrust of the book, so I took some of it out. But when you mentioned earlier that the exception to the female dominated world of Girls I Know, I had actually forgotten about Javier for a moment. I was wondering who you were going to mention, but But you're right. He's an economist, a PhD economist who lives across the hallway from Walt, and he's kind of a lonely guy too. Although you're right, he's not as lonely as Walt.
And he serves the role of friend and advisor. This is the closest that you're. I mean, Doug is. I mean, Doug. Sorry, Walt is kind of. He is sort of alienated in a basic way, and Javier is the closest he gets to having a friend.
Yeah, and I was interested in terms of, and we've talked about alienation a lot, mostly in terms of gender. I was really interested in terms of as well of just socioeconomic alienation, or the sense that Walt has through the first half of the novel. He's working as a superintendent of an apartment building in the Back Bay in Boston. It's kind of an exclusive, somewhat posh neighborhood, and he doesn't fit in there. Economically, and he's acutely aware of that. And I guess the one bond that he has with Javier is that they do at least share some kind of socioeconomic background. But I was interested in, with the three central characters, with Ginger, Mercedes, and Walt, I was really interested in trying to see if I could think about economic disparity, socioeconomic background through these three characters. I mean, it was kind of as an ex thought experiment to try to see what would come out of a novel in which we have a privileged, wealthy New York girl encountering a lower middle class guy from Vermont in Walt, and then a young African American 11-year-old girl who's because of the central event of the book, whose economic situation changes quite drastically. And so that was something that I was very excited about
Yeah,
in
well,
work.
it actually, I hadn't thought of that, but really, it was sort of while I was reading it, I was thinking about this, but that Walt has what used to be called in the 60s and 70s skin privilege. He's, you know, it's interesting to contrast. I mean, Ginger is well-to-do and privileged, and has everything possible, you know, including the Harvard undergraduate acceptance. And Walt, who is, you know, the fact that he's in graduate school at Harvard gives him this instant cachet in many places. You know, the Mercedes grandmother who's taking care of her, you know, she looks at him differently when she finds out he's at Harvard. Everyone, you know, everyone, you get accepted because you're a Harvard graduate student and he's white. That gives him status, even though he has no money.
Yeah, that's
Whereas, contrast to Mercedes and her family, who are truly struggling and have none of those privileges, and no, that's I think that is interesting. The interaction of them is very complicated and strained. You know, he is completely clueless about how to interact with people from a completely different cultural and economic background.
Well, I think if I could use your term of skin privilege for a moment, I think Walt would say at the beginning of the novel, there is no such thing as skin privilege because he wouldn't have perceived the advantages
Right.
that he acquired. But by the end of the novel, and basically it occurs at the end of the novel when he meets up with Ginger for breakfast, for brunch, the last time really, it's just in the penultimate chapter, and he says to her, I'm paraphrasing more or less, that her assumptions about class and race were wrong and right, because what Ginger said is, look, there's a divide, there is a difference between the experience of economic misfortune when you are not white and when you are white, and Walt learns that in the course of the novel, and I have to say I kind of learned that along with him in a way. I think as I entered the novel, I think I was more. I wanted to think about arguing more in terms of class difference and less in terms of race difference. And the characters in the novel, as they started to speak to me after I made it through a few drafts, kind of corrected some of the assumptions that I had had. And so that was not something that evolved. I don't want to say maybe organically, because that might be. Now he's stretching, but certainly in terms of the design I had of the novel, I hadn't anticipated the degree to which Walt would learn about that.
Oh, that's interesting. Well, you know, what you're, and I think probably people don't realize it, you know, that novels don't just spring fully formed from the brow of the writer, and
No.
that, it's a process. So it is interesting. I've heard this from other writers talking about their novels, that they learn from their characters. They go through a process. You go through a process as a writer along with your characters.
That's right, and I was going to say for those, because there are other writers who might say that they work from an outline, they stick to the outline, and they write in that manner. I mean, I do an outline, but I change it every time I sit down at the table. But for me, if I didn't do that, I wouldn't want to write, I don't think. I think part of it's that discovery, that those unanticipated moments of insight or revelation, or when something just changes that makes writing for me so exciting. And although it's a lot of work, it seems less like work in my mind than if I established a recipe for a book and then sat down and put the ingredients together. That
Right.
just wouldn't seem the same to me.
Right. Well, that's you've what you've described probably is the joy of the creative process, that but that's it still is it's hard work. You have to stay with it, and not everyone can do that.
Yeah, there is so much stubbornness that is required, and it's complicated, I think, as well, because you have to be able to listen to people, but you can't listen to everyone either. So you have to remain, there's a kind of balance between a commitment to a book project and also enough flexibility to realize when something isn't working or when you have to try something from a different, quite literally sometimes a different point of view. I mean, there was the short story that Girls I Knew grew out of, which was in my first collection, which is the title of the story is also Girls I Know. But in that early version, it was in the first person. It was in Walt's head. And when I started to turn it into a novel, which was always my intention, I struggled with it for a few months, and I realized it was just because I actually couldn't write the novel from Walt's point of view. It had to be from a perspective that could inhabit a number of different characters. And so that was the first of these of many moments in the composition of the novel where my own assumptions changed pretty dramatically. But again, it was just a discovery along the way, and it's one of the funny things about when you then finish a book and you give it over to to readers, and there is something a little bit melancholic about that. I mean, that's something that I think once you create that world and it's working in a way, and you inhabit it and think about it. It's hard to leave it behind because, of course, when you move on to your next book, then you have to start from scratch, and the rules that applied to your previous book don't necessarily apply to what you're working on next.
Right, unless your characters don't go away and you're kind of forced by them to tell more stories. But
Right.
obviously that's not, or it sounds like that's not what's happening for you.
I mean, it's funny because I feel like I could write more about Mercedes. I'd be really interested in following her life. I think Walt has, as we've talked about, his resolution toward the end of the novel is to become a teacher, but I think he's going to have a hard time teaching, actually. I think he's a little bit naive about what that entails. And, Javier, his friend, his hallmate, alerts him to that. So, in a way, I think the novel ended appropriately for Walt. I think Ginger is someone who the next project she undertakes is going to probably have some similar dimensions to the Girls I Know project that she completes at the end of this novel. I don't know if she's evolving so much as she's on a treadmill in a way.
Right, or else she's going to become, the next Joyce Carol Oates or something,
Right,
who
right.
writes 30 novel, 30 books and short
Right.
stories and criticism, because she's completely just wrapped up in having to express herself.
Right, she could do that. Yeah, more power
Well,
to her.
right. So, what if before this, before we end, what is the next book that you're working on? Are you working on
Okay,
something right now?
I am. Well, I'm working on a collection of stories, and I've got about, I guess, 8 of the 10 more or less wrapped up. One of them is coming out in a journal called New Letters that Bob Stewart edits. And it's coming out in the fall, and it's actually a story that is a chapter of a novel that I'm just starting that's set in Denver, really, where I grew up, that is about the discovery of a family that's much more complicated than the central character thought originally. It's also a sort of re-exploration of the West, a kind of an attempt on my part to dismantle some of the romanticism associated with what it meant to go West, what it means to be a Westerner, and that kind of thing. So I'm going to hopefully finish up the next few stories. Another one's coming out in the Minnesota Review in the fall. So I've got two or three more to go on that, and then I'm just going to turn my attention to my next book and disappear, sadly, but also with some joy for a little bit, go back to my cave.
Well, obviously, you're having fun doing that, so.
Yeah, no, I love what I do. So, and it's just great to be able to talk to you about the book and to field your great questions. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. It was really fun talking to you. Well, thanks a lot, Doug Trevor. This has been Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm David Wilk. We've been talking about Girls I Know by Douglas Trevor, and a book I recommend. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, David.